Lesson 251, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, 1743, the work of F.S. Paris. If you're joining us right now live or watching this after the fact, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down under Recent Sermons to January 12th, click on the link for Lesson 251, and you can load the notes and follow along with us as we go through this material. So, we've had a bit of a two-week break here. No, it's been more like 2 weeks or 3 weeks? 3 weeks? 2 weeks? I don't know. 2 weeks. Oh. Last time we met was the 22nd, and so there were 2 weeks over the holidays. Yeah, okay. All right, so last time we met, I taught lesson 250, so I want to jump right into this, and I do have a little bit of a review, just so everybody can kind of get our bearings on where we were at last time that we had class, okay? So, again, Lesson 251, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, 1743, the work of F.S. Paris, Introduction. Recall that in Lesson 249, we began using Dr. Gordon Campbell's work, Bible, The Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011, to frame a discussion of the editorial work for Cambridge University Press, of F.S. Paris for Cambridge University Press in 1743 and 1762. In Lesson 250, we revisited the examples covered in Lesson 249 in light of new research. Most notably, the 1683 Cambridge Quarto Edition, H780, my friend and fellow researcher Christopher Yetzer uncovered the importance of this heretofore overlooked edition. Additional examples drawn from the work of David Norton were also considered in Lesson 250. Remember that of the 63 examples noted by Norton in the main text of A Textual History of the King James Bible, 23 of them, or 36.5%, had already been edited in 1683 by Cambridge University Press in their quarto edition. So that's new information, okay? Remember what I've said about how most of the collating work that has been done has only taken into consideration the large folio editions and not the lesser editions. And again, by lesser editions, I mean smaller sized editions. The quarto, the octavo, the duodecimo editions, those are what I'm referring to when I use the idea of lesser editions. So, all told, we concluded the following Lesson 250. Number one, ascribing the precise date of origin for a given reading in the printed history of the King James text is a cautionary tale unless one has looked at every edition ever printed. Okay? Do you understand the amount of time that would take to do that? It would, even if you have access to every single one of them, to flip to them either digitally or manually, every single one to look at one reading in one verse would take forever. All right? Number two, the work of Campbell and Norton, while extremely helpful and beneficial, is not definitive and needs to be checked against other printings. So if you're reading their works and they say this reading came into existence in this year, you take it, you say, okay, maybe that's true. I need to look at some other printings, other editions, but you need to not take that as a definitive statement because chances are maybe it's not. All right. Number three, the printed history of the King James text is not as neat and tidy as many would like it to be. The text was never printed with uniformity between 1611 and 1769. Editorial changes were made to the text despite the claims of some to the contrary. This is why demanding verbatim identicality of wording as a standard for preservation is an unhelpful standard and logically leads to one having to declare which edition printed everything perfectly to the exclusion of all others. Okay? Number three, it is not correct to think of the history of the text in terms of four monolithic revisions occurring in 1629, 1638, 1762, and 1769. The real story unfolds year by year, printing by printing. So we've documented this, we've cataloged it, right? We know this is the case. If nearly 36% of the changes that Paris made in 1743 were already done in 1683 and nobody knew it, is there a high probability that there's other changes being made that nobody knows about because they haven't had the opportunity to look at all the printings, okay? So, therefore, the following statements are grossly incorrect. I'm not going to read the statement again. It's there for you to consider on your own. Go to the top, page 2. The last point, I think this is the fourth main point here. No, fifth main point. The 1683 Cambridge Quarto, H78, seems like a massively undervalued edition when assessing the printed history of the text. This is interesting given that the 1683 was the last Cambridge edition to be published until the Paris edition of 1743. So remember what we've already seen, right? Did Cambridge University Press go dormant for a period of time in the late 1600s, early 1700s, and were they collecting an honorarium to forego their right to print the text for a number of years, okay? Recall that in terms of printing Bibles, the Cambridge University Press went dormant for a period in the late 17th and early 18th century, given that more than 35% of the changes ascribed to Paris by Norton and Campbell had already been made in 1683, one wonders if Paris utilized the last Cambridge printing as the base text for his work. I think it is a more than reasonable assumption to say that when Paris is going to start doing the text again for Cambridge, he went and got the last Cambridge text and used that as a base. That seems perfectly reasonable to me that he would have done that, especially given the fact that 35% of the changes ascribed to Paris had already been made in this earlier edition from 1683. Okay? So, in this lesson, we're going to cover two more issues that are covered by Campbell. So, in this lesson, we're going to cover the following additional categories of examples noted by Professor Campbell. The first one is apostrophes and possessive forms. And the second one is idioms and modern forms. So, that would be modern spellings, modern forms of a word. Okay? So, let's pick this up here with this first main point. Before we do that, does anybody have any comments or questions?
Did Cambridge give up its printing right or just decided not to print it and give printing rights to another?
They did not give up the right.
But I mean, could they have continued printing if they wanted to?
Yes.
That's what I was thinking.
They could have continued to print if they wanted to, but they chose instead.
As well as give the right?
No, I think there was an economic arrangement where they were collecting, I think if my memory's not mistaken, £80 a year.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who the party was that started paying them that, but they were being paid £80 a year to forego the execution of their print patent. In other words, they could print other stuff, they just couldn't print what? Bibles. Okay. And then they decide in the... Remember there was that syndicate, remember the syndics and the syndicate, they decided they want to get back into that, and that was like late 1730s, early 1740s, and this 1743 by Paris was their first edition since the last one in 1683.
And at that time, did that other printing press stop printing projects then?
Well, I don't know what they did, but they clearly, Cambridge was no longer going to collect the honorarium.
Yeah.
So, all right.
You know how you said it would take a long time to do what they were going to do earlier? Do you think they had pools of people, though? Maybe they had pools of people that read different Bibles or whatever. They read...
I don't. So you're talking about when I was referring to Campbell and Norton and collating things. I mean, they might have had research assistants. They could have had research assistants. But even if that's true, they didn't. They only collate the folio editions. They don't look at the lesser printings. If they had their catalog, their record of things would look very different than it actually looks. Okay. Any other questions before we move on to apostrophes and possessive forms? Okay, so picking up the text where we left off in lesson 249, Dr. Campbell goes on to state the following regarding the editorial work of F.S. Paris in 1743. Quote, in the 1611 Bible, possessives were indistinguishable from normative forms. But in the second quarter of the 18th century, apostrophes had begun to represent possessive forms. Okay? Paris therefore inserted possessive apostrophes throughout the text. All right? So let's look at this first one. We're going to do a deep dive on so you can see what I'm talking about. Then the next ones, I'm going to take a layer of this, a bunch of layers of this out because you'll see that they're irrelevant moving forward. So just bear with me as we go through this first example. Okay? So, consider the following example of apostrophes being added to the text of the AB by Paris in 1743, okay? So, the first example we're going to look at is 1 Chronicles 7:2. And I have a screenshot here from the base text of the 1602 bishops, right? And this is what we're looking at. Households of their fathers. Notice how fathers is spelled. F-A-T-H-E-R-S. What does it not have?
Apostrophe.
Okay? So what Paris, sorry, what Campbell just said is that in 1602, had apostrophes come into use yet in English to indicate possessive forms?
No.
Okay? So there are no apostrophes in the 1602 Bishop's Bible because they were not a thing yet in English grammar. Is everybody following that? Okay? Now, let's just look at this verse. It's a little hard to read, okay? It's...
Sons,
what's that? Go ahead, Mike.
No, I was in a different place. Go ahead.
And the sons of... Would help if I just...
Choler,
I think. And then list them out, okay? List out all the sons. Which were heads in the households of their fathers. Okay? Now in the context, is it clear that all these names are the heads of the households of their fathers? Even though there's no apostrophe S. Okay? Let's look at the next example. Go to page 3. Notice the 1611. Okay? Go top page 3. Notice the 1611 says, heads of their father's house. So has there been some rewriting being done by the King James translators from where we started, where it said, in the households of their fathers, that was the 1602 bishops, and then the 1611 becomes heads of their fathers what? So here's my point. Was that clause redone by the King James translators? Yes or yes?
Yep.
Yes, okay. But notice with fathers, it's still not what? There's still an apostrophe S. Okay? Is everybody following this? Okay, let's look now at that verse in the 1683 Cambridge Quarto. Notice, heads of their father's house. Again, there's still no apostrophe S on what?
Fathers.
Okay? Let's go to page 4. So on the top page 4, we see the Paris edition of 1743. And notice what we see here for the first time. Heads of their father's house. And now this has an apostrophe S indicating what?
Possession.
Okay? Or the possessive form. All right? So let's look at this point here underneath this screenshot. In the case, by the way, I have digital copies. Even in these digital copies, I still have to scroll through the whole thing, up and down and back and forth to find the verse I want. It takes a long time. So that's why I'm saying, back to the question you asked a moment ago, like even if somebody had digital copies of every single one of these Bibles, the amount of time that it would take to literally track every one of these is just insane. Okay? You go cross-eyed after a while. I'm serious. So, let's read underneath here. In the case of 1 Chronicles 7:2, neither the base text of the 1602 bishops nor the 1611 have an apostrophe in father's house in this verse. Neither does the 1683 Cambridge Quarto H780. This change does truly appear to date from the editorial work of Paris in 1743. Okay? So based upon what we can check it against, it seems to be the case that Campbell is right in this statement. Okay? Now, for the first example, we have provided screenshots of 4 different Bibles. I gave you the 1602, the 1611, the 1683, and the 1743 to demonstrate the timing and nature of the change. For the rest of the apostrophe examples below, I provide an image from the edition in which the change was first made to the best of my knowledge. While the 4 prior Bibles have been checked, for example, only a screenshot of each change has been provided. So starting with the one here in Judges 11:2, I still checked the other 3. There were no apostrophes, so I left those screenshots out, And I just gave you a screenshot of the one that had the apostrophe. Okay? Now, before we move on, Amy, did you, I believe, did you grab 1 Chronicles 7 2?
I had it, but I'm now in Judges.
Okay. Somebody grab 1 Chronicles 7 2 and tell me if there's an apostrophe on fathers.
There is.
So all the Bibles in front of you have the apostrophe S on fathers. Should. They should have it as a standard 1769 reading. Okay? So, let me just rephrase what I just said. So for all the examples that we're going to see, starting with Judges 2:11, I looked at a 1602, a 1611, and that Cambridge 1683 to see if they had apostrophes in these verses. They did not. So I only gave you a screenshot of the verse that added the apostrophe. Does that make sense? Okay, so Judges 11:2. 1743, Paris, okay? Notice, and his wife's sons grew up. So the apostrophe is added to what?
Wives.
Okay? So it's indicating possession. So it's not wives, as in like more than one wife, it's the sons belonging to this wife. Does that make sense? And does that have an apostrophe?
Yes.
Yep. So that is in the current text. Get 1 Chronicles 7:40. Did we already do that one? No, we did 7:2. Get 1 Chronicles 7:40. Here's another one of fathers, okay? Heads of their father's house. Paris inserts the apostrophe here before the S. All of the other ones just had fathers, F-A-T-H-E-R-S, no apostrophe. Paris inserts the apostrophe in 1743. And I believe the apostrophe is still there, correct?
Yep.
All right, get Nehemiah 7:61. Nehemiah 7:61. Here's another example of fathers. They could not show their father's house. Again, apostrophe S added by Paris here in 1743. And I believe, again, that that is the current standard reading, is it not?
Yep.
Apostrophe S in Nehemiah 7:61. Okay. Psalm 6:4. Notice this is an interesting one. Psalm 6:4. Return, O Lord, deliver my soul. O save me for thy mercy's sake. So this is the mercy that belongs to who?
The Lord.
Okay? So before this was just M-E-R-C-Y-S, no apostrophe. Paris inserts the apostrophe in 1743 to Psalm 6:4. And I believe that is still the standard reading, is it not? What's that?
They updated the spelling, but yes.
Is that, okay, so the spelling's updated, but is the apostrophe there?
Yeah.
At the end, after the S.
Where's the one in your Bible, Eli? Okay, so this is interesting, right? So, I'll be honest with you, like I don't know what to erase here. What is the correct form for Ross's? R-O-S-S apostrophe at the end? Or R-O-S-S apostrophe S?
If it's possession, it's apostrophe S.
Okay, so you guys are telling me that mercies here is with an apostrophe at the end of the word.
But if it ends with an S, then the apostrophe goes.
That's why I'm saying, if it's Ross's, is it R-O-S-S apostrophe or R-O-S-S apostrophe S?
Maybe they mean multiple mercies here.
Maybe.
I mean, then it would be correct.
Yeah. I'm assuming that the Lord has more than one mercy, right? I mean, like, but the point is, before this point, was there any apostrophe here at all?
No.
Now you're saying it's been relocated to the end of the verse. And I do remember looking at that, now that you guys say that. I look at so many of these examples in a given week that I forget stuff. Look, and then you have the same thing happening in Psalm 31:16, and then again in Psalm 44:26, where Paris is adding apostrophe S's here, And I believe these are probably the same in the current readings where the S or the apostrophe is at the end, right? For both of them, I'm assuming.
I think for mercies plural, there would be no apostrophe. Just want to throw that out there. Big grammar guy, you know.
You are the grammar guy. His mom laughs for the record.
I have no idea.
So what you're saying is, if it's the apostrophe indicates to me a it has to indicate possessive, right?
Yes.
If it's apostrophe, yes.
So the apostrophe at the end, like, see, this is where like I should know my own grammar better. Okay, here's what I know for the first 130 years of the King James text, were there any apostrophes in these verses?
No.
Then somebody puts it in like this, and then somebody put it in a different way. And then is that the way that it's been basically ever since? Okay? So what's going to be interesting is when we get to the 1769, to come back through a couple of these verses and see if the apostrophes moved. Okay? Is everybody following what I'm saying?
Yep.
All right, go to page 6.
I just told Michael, I said, I think of it as an uppercase comma.
Look at Psalm 104:3, okay? It's talking here, they have sharpened their tongues like a serpent, adder's poison is under their lips, okay? So there's apostrophe S possessive on adders, all right? I believe that is still the way it is now, or no? Is it at the end?
It's at the end.
It's at the end. So there's another change. So these things are changing even from what he's got. Okay, look at Daniel 2:41. Whereas thou sawest the feet and the toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, potter's clay with the apostrophe S. I'm not even going to... Well, you guys tell me, which way is it?
It was moved over after the S.
It's moved over after the S in the one that you guys have. Okay? So did somebody change it again?
Yeah.
So, Paris... So here's what this would tell me. Possessives have come into use by 1743, and is he adding them to the text? Mm-hmm. But are the rules of how to use them necessarily settled? Apparently not. And does somebody change it later on? After him. Okay. Daniel, we got Daniel right. Matthew 14, verse 9. And the king was sorry, nevertheless, for the oath's sake, and them that sat with him at meat, he commanded it to be given her. Alright? So oath has the apostrophe S on it. It did not have that before this point. I believe, somebody tell me on this one, Matthew 14:9, is it apostrophe or same as that?
Same.
It's the same, okay? Matthew or Mark 6:26. Another oath one, and the king was exceeding sorry, yet for his oath's sake, and for their sake, which sat with him, he would not reject her. So I believe that's the same, right? It's apostrophe S in the current text.
Yeah.
So the point here is this: up to this point, up till 1743, had there been any apostrophes in these verses? No. These are being added, and then apparently that they were revised later on from where Paris added them. Okay. So look at the bottom of page 6. In addition to these examples from the Paris Duodecimo edition of 1743, H1063, there are a couple more examples of apostrophes being added in the 1762 Cambridge Quarto edition, H1143, also edited by Paris. Okay, so go to top page 7. So this one here was not changed in the 1743 that we've been looking at, but this one was changed in the 1762 Paris Quarto edition, H43, And we have sort of your obligations shall be the priests belonging to who? The priests. And the current reading is what? Like this one?
Yes.
Apostrophe S. Okay. Now, so here's another observation we can make. Did Paris apparently catch all of these the first time he did this in 1743? Apparently not, because is he making an additional one here in 1762 that was not in the 1743? Does that make sense? So, is this an ongoing process now over... So just right there. So all these examples that we've seen so far, let me go back. I wasn't planning on doing this. Let's do this just for the sake of kicks and giggles. Okay? If you go back to page 4 is the first one. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 8, 9, 10, 11. So there's 11 that we looked at from 1743. Okay? Then when you go to the top of page 7, there's a 12th one that isn't recorded until 1762. So that right there disproves the idea that you have these four periods of revision happening in 1629, 1638, 1762, and 1769. That is just not accurate. That's just not accurate. These edits are being made almost addition by addition. Some obviously more than others are more impactful. Okay? So there are four more examples of possessive changes and use of apostrophes in the apocryphal section of the 1762 Cambridge Quarto edition H1143. At this time, these appear to have originated in Cambridge editions dating from 1762, seeing that the 1743 duodecimo edition did not contain the Apocrypha. So the small duodecimo edition that Cambridge printed in 1743 did not have the Apocrypha in it. This larger one does have the Apocrypha, and so you start to see the use of possessives. Now, I did not screenshot the apocryphal examples because I do not take the Apocrypha to be canonical text, and so I'm just going to mention them to you here, and you can go look them up should you want to do so. So, Wisdom of Solomon, verse 15, or chapter 15, verse 4, you see printers. Ecclesiasticus 13, 19, lions pray, apostrophe S on lions. Baruch 1, 4, kings, sons, apostrophe S on kings. And 1 Maccabees 10, 89, king's blood, apostrophe S on kings. Okay? Now, recall from above that Campbell said, quote, in the second quarter of the 18th century, apostrophes had begun to represent possessive forms. Paris therefore inserted possessive apostrophes throughout the text. That's from page 134 of Campbell. How should we view this category of editorial revision? So this is sort of the big question, right? How should we think about the use of these apostrophes? All right. Now, before I read the options to you, let me just tell you. I went to 5 English teachers in the English department at the school I teach at. And I said to them, I briefly explained the history and how apostrophes did not come into use until right around the middle of the 1700s. Okay? I explained to them that the text would say kings, K-I-N-G-S, and it was clear from the context whether it was possessive or not, but that in the middle of the 1700s they started adding apostrophes. And I asked them this question. I said, is the addition of the apostrophe a spelling change, or is it a English grammatical convention update? Okay, that's the question that I posed to them. And after I got a lot of weird looks for why in the world are you asking me this question, like some of them were like, this is bizarre, Ross, what are you up to? But anyway, after they kind of understood what I was saying, all of them said they thought it was a grammatical convention update, not a spelling change. Okay, so let's look at the options. Option one is this is a spelling change, the insertion of the apostrophe, all right? Which I struggle with that because all the letters are essentially what? The same letters. So there's no changing of the letters here, but you have the insertion of the apostrophe. Okay? So that to me is one option. Another option is that this is a grammatical update to reflect modern conventions for distinguishing between possessive and normative forms in English, in the English language.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Like, let's take the word kings, K-I-N-G-S. Is that, and then kings, like with apostrophe S, where it shows a possessive. Now, in the Greek or in the Hebrew, are those two different words? Is kings, like, to show it's plural, is a different word from kings, just to show that it's a possessive? Is that, are those two different words in Greek or Hebrew?
So, the short answer is, I have not looked up every example. Okay? However, if the language, English, at the time the King James translation is made, does not have in it a way of clearly delineating, that's not the fault of the English language, right? Because the language develops its grammar, its punctuation, its spelling, it's changing over time, right? So even if the Greek or the Hebrew had that information in it, which I admittedly have not done a lot of time looking at that, I would still not fault the translation for not having that if a way of representing that in the language did not exist at that point. Is everybody following what I'm saying? And I think almost all of these are clearly, you're able to figure them out given the context clues in the verses, what's going on, even without the apostrophes. So I don't think the apostrophe or no apostrophe is substantive, okay? But I do think, so what I've sort of decided for my own thinking is I think it's option two, okay? I think this is a grammatical update to reflect modern conventions for distinguishing between possessive and normative forms in the English language. That's what I think it is, okay? What are you laughing about?
Alex Hanna says the apostrophes were handed down from God, given through Gabriel, with the assistance from Michael the Archangel. Paris just picked them up and started peppering the text with them.
Thank you, Alex, for you. He's obviously being sarcastic. But I think it's option two.
Are there any other cases where apostrophes are used in English? Like in French,
you're saying.
Exactly.
As far as I can tell, Campbell is 100% right that apostrophes did not begin to be used in English until around the time Paris is doing this work in 7.
But
you know,
like you say, I can think of a spelling bee where you would say apostrophe S at the end of a word. You just say the letters.
Yeah, depending.
I'm not used to doing that kind of stuff.
They're probably not going to give you an apostrophe or a
spelling bee word.
Unless they put it in a sentence.
So,
that's how they do that.
So I just want to make two points, okay? I think that it's option two. I think this is a grammatical update in the convention of representing grammar in English. That's what I think it is. I struggle to see it as a spelling change because the letters are the same, okay? But what it does show you is the text that you have in front of you that I'm going to read from and preach from in less than an hour. Is it exactly the same as the text that came off the press in 1611?
No.
No, it is not. I don't understand why some people are so insistent that that this kind of thing that we can plainly see didn't happen. Okay? It obviously happened. All right, we got to move on or we're not going to finish. All right, idioms. The second point I want to talk about is idioms and modern forms. Now, that's not idiots, it's idioms. Okay. Idioms and modern forms. Dr. Campbell addresses another type of editorial change made by Paris in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 2. He says, quote, "Of Paris's changes in language designed to bring idioms up to date, the most striking," so there's probably other ones, we're just going to look at one here, Because it is in the mind of every reader of the KJV, is the change of no to not in the phrase that now reads, "And though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, and have not charity, I am nothing." In saying "and have not charity," the modern reader is recalling Paris, not the 1611 KJV. Okay? So the 1611 had no charity here. Paris changes "no" to what?
Not.
Okay? Now, obviously, you could say, well, that was a printer error. They accidentally left out the letter T. Okay? Well, let's explore the data to see if that is a reasonable thing to conclude. Okay? Now, let's look at the top page 8. This is another example of a phenomenon observed in Lesson 250. Campbell ascribes the change made to 1 Corinthians 3:2 to the work, 13:2, excuse me, to the work of Paris in 1743, when in fact the change had already been made in the 1683 Cambridge Quarto edition, H780. So this is yet another example of what we've already seen. Again, this error was made by Campbell because they only checked the large folio editions. Recall that the true history of the printed text unfolds year by year and printing by printing. Please consider the following evidence for 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 2. Okay? Now, as always, we're going to start with the base text. Okay? Notice the base text, 1602 Bishop says, "And have what?
Not charity."
Not charity. Okay? We should probably read the whole verse because it's going to change. And this is what 1602 said. "And though I have all prophecy and understand all secrets and all knowledge, yea, and if I have all faith so that I can remove mountains and have not charity, I am what?
Nothing."
Okay? So let's go down now and look at the 1611 because there's some edits that have been made. Okay? The first thing I want you to point out, or that I want you to notice here, is notice. The 1602 had what word? Underlined.
Not
charity. The 1611 has what?
No charity.
No charity. Okay? So let's look at this under the image of the 1611. The King James translators made numerous changes to the base text in what became the 1611 reading. Okay? Notice 1602 has and understand all secrets became and understand all mysteries. So look right here. Okay? And understand all secrets. They revised that here to and understand all what? So is there an intentional change by the King James translators in that clause?
Yes.
Yes. Okay? Did I miss one?
The 1602 Bishop said, "No, I have prophecy."
Yeah, you're right. I missed one. So that, Mike, you need to make a note that I need to note a change in the first line of the 1611. Related to the gift, yes. Okay? So we'll get that added to the notes that are put online. Look at the next one. "Yea" is stricken from the text. So go back up to the bishops. Notice there's a "yea" here, right? And all knowledge, colon, yea, comma. So there's a "yea" here in 1602. It's removed from the 1611. Now the point I'm making is this. Are the King James translators making intentional changes to this verse?
Yes.
Yes. So if they're making intentional changes to this verse, and we see a "not" become a "no," is it reasonable to assume that they wanted that reading? It's not out of the realm of possibility. Okay? Next is, "If I have all faith," is changed to read, "and though I have all faith." So if you look in the 1602, notice it says here, "If I have all faith." If you look in the 1611, it's changed to "and though I have all faith." So there's another intentional change there. And then if you go to the last one, it is "and have not charity." It is amended to read "and have no charity" in the 1611. So this is my point. When you observe all of the other changes that are being made to the verse, you have to be open to the possibility that them changing "not" to "no" is not a printer error. It could be the it could be what they wanted to say there, given all of the other changes that they made to this verse. Is everybody following what I'm saying? Okay? Now, to know for sure, you probably would need to do some more digging, which we've done. Go to the top of page 9. Therefore, the change from not charity in 1602 to no charity in 1611 appears to be intentional on the part of the King James translators. While it might seem that the 1611 reading is a printer's error, the no charity reading is a match with Tyndale, Matthews, and Great Bibles, which read no love in 1 Corinthians 13:2. Moreover, later editions, such as the 1629 and 1638 Cambridge editions, retained the no charity reading. So they don't change it in 1629 or 1638 when the Cambridge editors do this. They retain the no reading. Consequently, the 1611 reading of no charity seems to have been the intentional choice of the King James translators, electing to follow the Tyndale, Matthews, and Great Bible reading in this case, according to Rule 14. So remember our rules. Rule 1 is to follow the bishops unless the truth of the original said otherwise, right? Rule 14, if they're not going to follow the bishops, are they supposed to check the other English Bibles? And lo and behold, 3 of the previous English Bibles have the reading no there, not what? Not. So is it extremely plausible that they say no on purpose? That that is their choice? Yes. Okay? Now, let's look at Cambridge, 1629. The 1629 Cambridge editors elect to make no changes to the verse. So, according to my comparison, which you know is not infallible, I do miss things from time to time, I see no changes to this verse made by the Cambridge editors in 1629. Okay? I went clause by clause, compared them, and I didn't see any changes. So if you find one, let me know and I'll correct it. But the main point is, in 1629, what do they do here? They leave it as what?
No charity.
No charity. Now let's go to the 1638. Before we talk about 1638, some friends of mine online who like to be critical of me say that 2 translators, Boyce and Ward, assisted with the 1638 to make adjustments and make corrections. Okay? So let's operate with that assumption. I do think Boyce and Ward, the evidence suggests Boyce and Ward were there, but notice what happens to the verse. Okay? The 1638 Cambridge editors made the following changes to 1 Corinthians 13:2. Okay? They put the gift in italics. It's in italics now, the gift of. So let's add the of to that. We should probably add of to that. So that is now in italics. It was not before. A comma is added after all mysteries that was not in the 1611 and the 1629. So, are they clearly doing editorial work on this verse? Yes. The colon, after all knowledge, is changed to a semicolon in 1683. Okay?
There's no space between knowledge, semicolon, or colon, and.
Say that again?
Knowledge, and the colon look like one word.
There's no in which space. One?
1689.
It's lacking a space, and yeah. I think that's fairly common.
Yeah, I don't. I think that's just a spacing of the font issue. But you are right; it does look a little different. Okay. Now, notice the spelling of charity is updated. Okay. Instead of being spelled C H A R I T I E. It is updated to the spelling that we're familiar with, charity, in 1638. Okay? So, they're making 1, 2, 3, 4, at least 4 edits to that verse. And Boyce and Ward are right there. What do they not change?
No.
They don't change the no charity reading.
No.
They changed the spelling of charity.
So obviously
they're updating that, but did they think that no should stay? No. Did they think no should stay? No.
Well, no and not mean exactly the same
thing. They mean exactly the same thing. So here's no, here's charity. Do they update this?
Yes.
But do they change this?
No.
No. So they literally update the word right next to this one, and they don't change this to a not. They leave it stand as what?
No.
No. So, when you stack the evidence, does the evidence suggest that the King James translators made the choice for that to say what?
Yeah.
No.
No.
That's
right. So don't get confused. Does the evidence suggest that their choice was it should read no charity?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Let's go to the next part of the example. So, despite these editorial changes, no charity reading was allowed to stand in the 1638. So, after this, we don't know that King James translators are dying, they're passing away. Okay. The first known change to the no charity reading occurred in the 1683 Cambridge Quarto edition, H780. Okay, go to the top, page 10. Okay? So here we have this 1683 Cambridge Quarto reading, H780, okay? And notice what I've got underlined here.
No.
Now it's what?
No.
Not. So are the translators way dead and gone by 1683? Even the oldest one would have been dead by this point. Okay, now, let's look at the verse. The 1683 Cambridge edition makes the following changes in 1 Corinthians 13:2 when compared against the 1638 Cambridge Folio edition. Okay, the comma after mysteries is removed. The semicolon after all knowledge is changed to a comma. Listen, these guys are just like any other English teacher today. Okay, I'm serious. These guys can't agree on when it should be a comma or a semicolon. I mean, if anyone can figure it out, you know, you let me know, okay? But here's the point. No charity is changed to what?
No.
Not charity. In 1683, okay? So, the not charity wording reinstated the original 1602 bishop's reading, thereby undoing what appears to have been the preferred reading of the translators of 1611. Therefore, instead of initiating this change, as asserted by Campbell, Paris inherited a Cambridge text in which this change had already been what? Made. Christopher Yetzer points out that the change could have been made to harmonize 1 Corinthians 13:2 with verse 1, which also... I don't know what that one is there for. Oh, with verse 1, I'm sorry. Which also reads, have not charity. So if you look in your Bible, somebody got the passage?
Yep.
Read verse 1, please, Amy.
So I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and have not charity, I have become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal.
Can you read verse 2 as well, please?
And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries, and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains, and have not charity, I am nothing.
Now, let me ask you just a question. What sounds better?
Not.
What sounds better when that is read out loud? For one of those to say not, and the other one to say no? Or for both of them to say the same thing? For both of them to say the same thing. And by the way, is there any substantive difference between no and not?
Obviously not.
The answer is no.
There's not.
No, there's not. Because it's bold, either way of saying it is saying the person is lacking what?
Charity.
Yes.
There's, you know, the lack of a space. In the 1683 Cambridge, there's no space after knowledge, comma. And then down here at 1743 Paris, that's correct. That's
yeah.
Just the printer's.
That's just a text layout issue.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. Okay. Now, does everybody understand what's going on here? Somebody told me that My class is now too technical.
1 Corinthians have not charity too. I just wanted to point that out.
But yes, I thank you for saying that. It's better, it sounds better if all of them say what?
Not.
Okay. So, 743, Paris, H, 1063, according to Professor Campbell. Okay. So, by the way, let me just got a little ahead of myself. This is just, so Campbell says it originates here with 743, not charity. The reason he says that is because he didn't look at which one? 1683, where the change had already been won. So when Paris sits down to do his work, is he inheriting a text that already says this? And he elects to what? To keep it, to not change it. Okay?
The reason I like it is because when you say no charity, it's more definitive to my way of thinking that you have none. Whereas not could be, in this case, you don't have charity. So it's even more critical that you have charity all the time. Just
I mean, I hear what you're saying. To me, either way, whether it says no charity or not charity, it's indicative of somebody who's lacking what?
Yeah.
Charity. Okay. So according to Professor Campbell, Paris also updated the spelling of words in his 1743 edition. Quote, Paris also changed words to modern forms such as, so sneezed became sneezed, the way we spell it now, 2 Kings 4:35. Had dedicate became had dedicated, 2 Kings 12:18. Curdled, spelled weird, became curdled, or cruddled. Cruddled became curdled. I mean, you don't want stuff to be cruddled. Job 10:10. To be heat became to be heated. Daniel 3:19. Where became aware in Matthew 24:50 and Luke 12:46. Abide, became abide in Romans 11:23, and inhabitors became inhabitants in Revelation 17:2. More radically, he changed fourscore to 80th in 1 Kings 6:1. Then he says this, I don't think I agree with him here, but he says, because fourscore was no longer acceptable as an ordinal number. Now, I'm going to show you at the end of the notes why I think he's not right about that. But
you got to talk to Lincoln on that.
Yeah.
What? What's that?
You got to talk to Lincoln on that.
Yeah. So, what I've got next on the next page is just screenshot evidence of this. Okay? So, here's 1743. Here we see the word sneezed spelled the way that we would typically more readily recognize it. Here's the change to dedicated in Job. Here's curdled instead of cruddled.
Now, is that just a correction of a verb error, or was cuddled actually a word?
I think it's the same word, but an earlier spelling of the same word. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but you know. You don't want anything cruddled, Mike. I'm just saying. Okay, go to page 12. Here we have the fiery furnace that it was wont to be heated with the ED. Here we have the where to aware in Matthew 24:50. Same thing here in Luke 12:46. Okay, now this is an interesting one again here. Notice Romans 11:23. This I can't find this one in the 1743, but I can find it in the 1762 Paris Porto in Romans 11:23, where bide becomes abide, and then Revelation 17:12 we have inhabitants instead of what was it, inhabitors or something like that, and then page 13. Oh, hang on one second. I missed something there. Notice this change. This Revelation 12:2 to inhabitants first happened where? This was done before Paris. This is you should be at the bottom of page 12. Bottom of page 12. Notice that the change to inhabitants happened first in 1683 with the Cambridge Quarto edition H780 and not Paris. So this is another example where Campbell missed something because he didn't look at this edition. Go to top page 13. Just a documentation of Paris making the change in 1743. Okay? So look at my note. Revelation 17:2 is another example of a change being made in the 1683 Cambridge Quarto H780 edition before the time of Paris. This, of course, means that Professor Campbell missed this change because he only collated the flagship folio editions. Okay? And then we get to this one, the last one that he gives about this four score thing. Okay? Notice 1 Kings 6:1. And here we have it again. Where is this happening first? 1683, not 1743. Okay? So the Cambridge Quarto H780 is making the change from four score to 80th way before Paris. Okay? Then the next image is the Paris text. So again, is Paris the first one to make this change?
No.
No, it's already made beforehand. Okay? So, page 14. Last bullet. Yet again, Paris was not the first editor to change fourscore to 80th in 1 Kings 6:1. The change had been made in the 1683 Cambridge Quarto H780 edition prior to the work of Paris. Despite the change recorded in 1 Kings 6:1, the word fourscore still appears 36 times in 35 verses in the current King James text. So you will still find the word fourscore 36 times in 35 verses. If you go to Blue Letter Bible, type in fourscore, hit enter, and run it, it's 36 times in 35 verses in the King James, in the standard text that you have in front of you. Okay? So consequently, Campbell's comment, fourscore, was no longer acceptable as an ordinal number, seems to ring hollow. If that were true, why weren't all of them one? Why weren't all of the occurrences of fourscore updated to what? Some form of 80.
Well, the King James translators thought that fourscore sounded better when read aloud. That's
probably
one of those things that they went back and forth, and they were intentionally not consistent throughout.
I would agree with that. I think it's, so imagine Lincoln's speech 80 years ago versus, what, how's the speech go, 4 score in 8 years? Is that four, huh?
I think that's right.
So if he just says 88 years ago, that doesn't quite have the same rhetorical ring to it than standing there and reading the speech saying 4 score in 8 years. It just sounds better. Doesn't, I mean, I think it does. Maybe you guys don't agree, I don't know. But anyway, so it seems to me, though, that if it were true, if the statement were if his statement were absolutely true, then it would seem that all the occurrences of fourscore would have been updated to what? 80. And in fact, the vast majority of them were not. This one was, and we don't have an explanation from anybody who did it as to necessarily why they did it. They just did it. Okay? All right, now, that brings us to the end of this lesson, and it's right at 10 o'clock, so we're not quite done yet with Paris, because next week we're going to look at another fun topic, and this is all the times that they change you to ye, or ye to you. Okay? It's fun times. But this has to be talked about, because it accents and underscores, again, an issue that exists that a lot of people don't want to deal with. Okay?